Hello and welcome to the 94 Feet Report. I am your host, as always, Eric Spiropoulos. You can follow me on Twitter at Eric Spiros. I just want to remind you that our sponsors today and as always are Fan Essentials. Use promo code 94 Feet at checkout for 30% off your first subscription. And by Daily Fantasy Nerd. If you check out the links in some of our episode descriptions and on Twitter, you can get some great Daily Fantasy tools as well. We have some really exciting and big changes happening to the show starting from this episode onward. We've decided to change the structure of the show due to the fact that we want to make it more about the name, the 94 Feet Report. So we now have divided our segments. We'll have six segments every show, and each segment will essentially be another step in covering the 94 feet of the NBA court. So as you'll see when we start off with the different segments, you'll see the names and, you know, how they explain a different part of the basketball court, and we'll be proceeding from one end of the court to the other to cover all 94 feet, essentially meaning that we'll also be covering the entire NBA in a certain structure. So with that being said, let's get into our first segment. All right, so this segment is the baseline, and essentially what the baseline is going to be is it's going to be a recap of the past week. We've done this before. It'll be like, you know, the top performers of the week, the top teams, the top stories, etc. So the baseline every week will be kind of a summary of the past week. So let's dive into it. In the past week of the NBA, let's start off with some of the top teams, or basically the hottest teams in the league so far in the past week. I want to talk about the Washington Wizards because, you know, they've been struggling a lot to start the season, but they've had four straight wins now, including a very impressive win versus the Clippers. Bradley Beal put up 41 points, and I saw on Twitter that he's the first Wizards player since Gilbert Arenas to put up at least two 40-point games in a season. So Beal stepping up his play. Wall has been elite so far this season. Beal has as well. So interesting with four straight wins, you know, one has to ask, you know, are the Wizards finally turning it around? I think they're only a game out of the playoffs, and that can change by the end of this week. They could be the sixth seed because of how, you know, weak the Eastern Conference is, which we'll get to in a little bit. But the Wizards are one of the hottest teams in the league. They've had all their wins have been at home, and most of them were against pretty bad teams, but the win against the Clippers was very impressive, in my opinion. The next team I want to talk about, I mean, how can you not talk about the Rockets if you're talking about hot teams? They've now won 10 straight games. It looked like their winning streak was going to come to an end Saturday night against the Timberwolves when they were down by 13 with 2 minutes to go and somehow tied the game and then won it in overtime pretty easily. Does it speak more about the Rockets or the Wolves that, you know, the Rockets won that game? People would argue that it was really spoke more about the Wolves and their inability to close out games. And it looked like the Wolves had reached a turning point, but they had just had another terrible loss to the Rockets on Saturday, but that doesn't take away from the rest of the Rockets' winning streak. It's now 10 straight. They actually haven't lost in December yet, so I think the Rockets are, it's pretty clear the Rockets are the hottest team in the league, but they're not the only team in the league with a winning streak, but the Rockets do have the longest one right currently ongoing, and it's been pretty impressive. And then some other three teams I want to talk about, the Utah Jazz, the Golden State Warriors, and the San Antonio Spurs all have four-game winning streaks. The Warriors, I believe, will be on pace if they can win their next couple games to set the mark for the second hottest or second best start to a season after their start last season when they were undefeated after, I think, 29 games. The Jazz have looked really impressive and are all the way up to the fifth seed in the Western Conference. And now with the news that Blake Griffin will be out 3 to 6 weeks, the Jazz are only two games behind the Clippers in the conference. So you never know, by the end of December, the Jazz could be the fourth seed or maybe even the third seed because they've been playing so well using that great defense. And the Spurs just keep on winning. They just had that great ceremony for Tim Duncan's jersey retirement. They're using great defense and a great road record to, you know, keep winning games. And they're only a game and a half behind the Warriors. So, you know, if you think the Warriors are just completely dominating, the Spurs are right behind them. So those are the teams that, you know, the top teams of the week, the hottest teams in the NBA right now. Let's move to performers of the week. There really aren't many. I want to mention James Harden because in his past five games, 25 points per game, 13 assists per game, 9.6 rebounds per game. He was a rebound away in that game against the Timberwolves from having three straight triple-doubles. And his passing, after a little bit of a dip, is now kicked back up to 13 assists per game in the past five games, and the Rockets have been winning, so he's a performer of the week. And then Russ, you have to mention the Westbrook 26-point, 22-assist, 11-rebound game against the Suns, and had one of the plays of the year when he just danced around the entire Suns lineup to dish it to Steven Adams for the dunk. Besides that, there really aren't any notable performers who really kept it up going the entire week. So in terms of that, but in other weeks, we'll definitely have more performers of the week as we have had in the past. And finally, to conclude the baseline for this week's episode, I want to talk about some cold teams, and they're both from the Eastern Conference, and they're both teams that, you know, it's a pretty divided expectations going into the season. Let's start off with the Chicago Bulls, because they now have three straight losses, and two of them were just terrible blowouts to the Bucks on a back-to-back, one in Chicago and one in Milwaukee. The Bulls look like kind of exactly what a lot of people predict them to be, kind of around 500, lack of three-point shooting, really going to kill them, and their defense has been horrible against the Bucks, and so that's, you know, some of the concerning signs about the Bulls that people thought they would have going into the season are now coming, you know, to reality. And the Knicks also have three straight losses, and one was versus the Suns, which wasn't a terrible loss, but the loss against the Nuggets, when Carmelo said before the game that it was essentially a must-win game and they went out and lost by like 14 to the Nuggets, is really bad. The Knicks are still a game over 500, but they haven't had a hard schedule, and they've been losing to some pretty bad teams, and their defense has been atrocious. Again, the Knicks, a team where, you know, kind of half the people thought they would be a playoff team, the other half thought they would miss the playoffs altogether. So kind of like the Bulls, pretty divided kind of expectations going into the season. But nonetheless, both the Bulls and the Knicks are struggling. We'll see if they can turn it around this week heading into the big Christmas Day games that they have. With that being said, that's going to conclude the baseline for this week. Again, it'll be mostly a kind of a short and sweet summary of the last week in the NBA. You know, talking about top teams, performers, storylines, etc. You know, it's kind of giving you the facts, giving you the reports, what you missed, etc. Not diving into the issues and giving a lot of opinions, of course. But that's what the baseline will be for the foreseeable future on the 94 Feet Report.
Get ready, because it's time for the Full Court Press.
That's right, our next segment is called the Full Court Press. And essentially, the Full Court Press will be our main segment. Each episode of the 94 Feet Report will dive in, spend a little bit more time on this segment, and dive into an issue that we like to talk about on the 94 Feet Report. And this week, we are happy to be joined by Alex Bropoulos again to discuss the Full Court Press. Alex, how are you doing today?
I'm good, Eric. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back.
So the Full Court Press, we decided to use it today to talk about the comparison between the Eastern and Western conferences, because it's been a story for, you know, probably the last decade how the conferences have been so, you know, not balanced, and the West has always usually been seen as the better conference. Last year, it looked like the Eastern Conference kind of took a step up, but it looks like they reverted back to, you know, kind of the West being better than the East. Heading into today, the recording of this episode, which is Monday, December 19th, the record between the conferences, the West is 84-71 against the East. So a pretty comfortable margin for the West right there. And the thing is that when you look at the standings, you look at the standings between the conferences, and I can tell you now, the 7th seed Oklahoma City Thunder would be the 3rd seed in the Eastern Conference.
Right.
So how, I mean, isn't that just incredible? I mean, the fact that the 7th seed in the West would be the 3rd seed in the East. Or is it the fact that the 3rd seed in the East is only 3 games over 500?
I know, that is a bit concerning, though. And then if you look at some of the 3rd and 4th seeds in the West, they'd be vying for the number 1, number 2 seeds in the East pretty comfortably.
The Rockets are the 3rd seed in the West, and they would literally basically be 0.1 percentage points behind the Cavs for the number 1 seed.
Right.
They'd be, what is it, half a game behind for the 1st seed?
Yeah, and I think they'd be like statistically tied because they have 2 more wins.
Exactly.
Them, so.
The Clippers are the 4th in the West. They would be the 2nd in the East. We said the Thunder were the 7th in the West. They would be the 3rd in the East. And the thing is, we can dive into these playoff matchups, go, you know, 1v1, 2v2, 3v3. Again, it's so early that these aren't obviously going to be the standings at the end of the year, most likely. But there's a really good chance that these might be the playoff teams at the end of the year, at least in the West. I think the Western Conference playoff teams are already decided.
Probably set, yeah.
even though the Nuggets are only one game behind the Trailblazers, I think the Trailblazers were turning around enough. But if you go 1v1, Cavs versus Warriors, I don't know. I mean, right now I'd pick the Warriors because they're playing better in the regular season.
That's probably the only one where you'd actually have a series, and just given their history and the Cavs could, like, you know, they found ways to beat the Warriors, although they didn't have Durant last year. But I think you can make an argument that Cavs could beat the Warriors.
Oh yeah, I think that you can clearly make the argument the Cavs would beat the Warriors, and I think it's one of the only ones that we'll see in matching up the playoff seeds that you would actually argue that the Eastern Conference would win, because the 2-seed Raptors, while they're playing great and actually have the best offensive rating in the league, which is surprising, I would not pick them against the Spurs in a 7-game series right now.
No, I would not.
Maybe
no.
If they actually played in the playoffs and the Spurs would be one out by then, maybe. But right now, the Spurs are rolling, and the Raptors are essentially rolling as well. But right now, I would not pick the Raptors to beat the Spurs. Again, I think it'd be close, but I'd pick the Spurs. So I guess you want to call it... I guess if we want to be nice to the Eastern Conference, we can call it 1-1 right now and give the Cavs the series and give the West the Spurs. I don't know. That's me being generous because we're going to quickly see how it's going to turn all into the West's favor. The third seed, Rockets against the Celtics, that's pretty clear. The Rockets already beat the Celtics this year, and they're significantly better.
Right.
I mean, the Celtics are 15-12. The Rockets are 21-7. So, I mean, that's a significant difference. The Clippers, now, I mean, you have to consider the fact that they don't have Blake if they were to match up right now. But even then, the Clippers at the 4 seed against the Hornets, I'd still go with the Clippers.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, now the only thing I'll say about the Eastern Conference is that it's essentially balanced in a way where there's two great teams, Cavs and Raptors, and then from 3 to basically 11, the teams are either two or three games over to 2 or 3 games under. It's right. They have very similar records. So basically, by the end of this week, the Wizards could probably be the 4th seed.
Right, and they're right now they're only 2.5 games back of the Celtics, who are the 3rd seed.
Which is incredible because the Wizards are the 11th seed right now.
Exactly, the 11th seed, and have not been playing very good basketball.
That's the only thing interesting about the East, is that, like, the because the West, we kind of are like, you know what, these are going to be the playoff teams. But the East, it's like, I have no idea, because the Wizards are 11 right now, and they're only 2 games back from the 3rd. So
right. It's
going to change so much. And plus, I still think the Pistons and the Hawks and the Wizards will somehow squeak in, so that means they're going to have to replace 3 other teams, in my opinion. So we'll see about that. But keep it going. We already did Clippers against the Hornets, so that makes it 3-1 West, or possibly 4-0 if you're...
Yeah, it's depending.
So 5 Utah Jazz against 5 Milwaukee Bucks. I'm going with the Jazz.
Yes, Jazz.
The Bucks do seem kind of like the Eastern Conference Jazz, though, in my opinion, but use defense to win games. But the Jazz are significantly better. The Grizzlies at 6 against the 6-seed Knicks. I'm picking the Grizzlies.
Grizzlies. Again,
I'm pretty sure the Knicks already beat the Grizzlies, but that was like early, really like the first week of the year. But again, you never know when the Grizzlies are going to be healthy. So.
Right.
But the 7-seed Thunder, we already said, would be the 3rd seed in the East anyway, so I'm going to comfortably pick them to beat the Pacers in a series. Now, I'm talking about 1 game because, you know, anyone could beat anyone on 1 night.
But
I'm talking
about seven game series.
Exactly. And then this one is the one where I'll pick the East, because I'll pick the Bulls over the Blazers if they met in the series right now, because the Blazers have just been awful. Their defense is so bad, and they keep disappointing. I mean,
right, and that's something that you'd pick the Bulls now, but I think maybe at the end of the year you might end up picking the Blazers if they can turn things around. Because like you said, if the 8th seed could be the Bulls, it could end up being any one of the Pistons, the Hawks, or the Wizards. You'd have to see if that would change depending on the matchup.
Yeah, I know. As of right now, I'd pick the Bulls. If they were to meet in a playoff series right now, at this moment, I would pick the Bulls. So even if I'm being generous, that makes it 6-2 West. But honestly, realistically, I would pick the Warriors, so that makes it 7-1 West. If the playoff seeds were to match up from each conference at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
Being said that, I mean, it's pretty clear that the West, you could argue, the East you would argue is more top heavy, obviously, because there's 2 great teams and then the next team is 15-12.
Right.
While the West, if you get rid of the Blazers, 1 through 7 are all good teams, and it's, you know, the 4th seed is only 4 games out of the, you know, the top seed there.
That's true.
So
yes.
I think the East is obviously more top heavy. And the interesting thing is that the Eastern Conference used to be known as that more like defensive conference, like a lot more, you know, top defensive teams, while the West used to be the run and gun West, like all the top offensive teams would be in the West. But the interesting thing is that 6 of the top 10 teams in defensive rating are from the West. And the West is still keeping the offensive dominance, because 7 of the top 10 offensive rating teams are also in the West.
That's interesting. So
it's not like it used to be, where it used to be all the top offenses would be in the West and all the top defenses would be in the East. It's really more balanced. In fact, the West is honestly dominating in terms of like having the best teams are coming from the West. Because you would argue, you would throw in the Cavs and the Raptors, but four of the top six teams in the league, you would argue, are from the West, being the top four teams in the West right now, and then you throw in the Cavs and Raptors. So,
right.
As of right now, and I think it'll stick the rest of the season, it's pretty clear the West is better 1 through 8, and even their top teams are better than the Eastern Conference teams, and their bottom seeds are even significantly better than the Eastern Conference bottom seeds.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it takes something into consideration when you have a West team and you're analyzing them versus an East team. You know, is the team better than the other? Where you say they play in the West, it's a significantly better conference.
Right, and 2 points I want to make about the comparison of the conferences is that if you actually look at the breakdown, only two teams in the East have a winning record against winning teams in the league. That's the Cavs and the Raptors. Looking at the West, six teams have a winning record against teams that are 500 or better, which is the Warriors, Spurs, Rockets, Clippers, Jazz, and Thunder. So if you look at that, the East are playing lesser quality opponents, if you're going down more teams under 500, but yet they still don't have winning records. They can't get the victories against the teams that are actually good in the NBA, unlike teams in the West. Also looking, if you know, for moving aside from the playoff teams, if you look at the teams that are sort of struggling this year in the West and the East, if you look at the teams in the West, you would tend to say that they have more potential to become good teams. If you look at teams like Minnesota, Phoenix, New Orleans, Lakers, Sacramento, Denver, I'm not including Dallas because I don't think that...
See what they do with their draft.
Right, exactly. Those are all teams that you could make an argument that in 3-4 years from now, they could be over 500 teams.
You would argue that they should. Some people pick the Wolves to be over 500 comfortably this year, and they suck.
Right.
Yes.
And then, but if you're going to the East, aside from Philadelphia, I mean, Brooklyn, you'd have to see if they give them a couple. They don't have the pieces there right now that you would say in 3-4 years they should be a winning team. Miami, again, from Whiteside, no. Orlando.
They got young players, but it looks like management holds them back.
I mean, Wizards should be a winning team. The Hawks should be a winning team. And Detroit is always around 500 or so. But those are not teams that are ready to break out and not be they're not going to be competing for the top 3-4 seeds in 5 years from now. Although you could make an argument that Minnesota could be competing in 3-4 years. You know, Denver could be competing depending on how those players develop as well. So if you're looking at the West, it's not only better in the sense that their playoff teams are better, but the teams that aren't in the playoffs have more potential than their counterparts in the Eastern Conference looking forward. So
yeah, the West is better now, and they have a brighter future in terms of their non-playoff or their lottery teams.
Right.
So I think this Western Conference dominance is going to continue for the foreseeable future at least.
And now, the half-court heave.
So this is the next segment in the 94 Feet Report. It's called the Half Court Heave. And essentially this segment will be a prediction for the next week. Sometimes the predictions will be more long term, but usually I'm going to try and tailor them to be predictions for the week. And then we'll, you know, briefly discuss about the prediction we make on the show, obviously. So this week I think we both have two different predictions. I'll go with mine first. Again, these are half court heaves, you know, very unlikely that they're going to happen, but you might as well have fun and make a weird and wacky prediction and just see if it comes true. My prediction for this week will be that all away teams will win on Christmas Day. So that means the Celtics will beat the Knicks in New York, the Warriors will beat the Cavs in Cleveland, the Bulls will beat the Spurs in San Antonio, the Wolves will beat the Thunder in Oklahoma City, and the Clippers will beat the Lakers in L.A. Well, that's not really an away team, but still, that does count. Again, I mean, I'm predicting that the Celtics will win regardless, and I think the Warriors will actually win regardless, but I'm a little bit less confident on the Bulls and Wolves game, but hey, I had to make the prediction, so I had to pick all of them to win. So my half-court heave for the week will be that all away teams will win their games on Christmas Day. What is your half-court heave, and kind of explain?
So my half-court heave this week is that the 76ers will go 3-0 this week. They are playing at home versus New Orleans, at Phoenix, and at Sacramento. I think that, and the games are equally separated apart. You know, they have 3 days between, or 2 or 3 days between each game. That's partly due to the Christmas break. But I think that the 76ers have been playing better basketball of late. I think that, you know, these are teams that they can beat and they should beat if they want to take that next step. So I think that they're going to go 3-0 this week against the Pelicans, the Suns, and the Kings.
So this is our new segment on the show again. It's called 3 points because we're at the 3-point line. And essentially each week we will make 3 points about random NBA topics that, you know, I've either come up with on my own doing research, have seen on Twitter, have seen some articles about, some people are debating about on talk shows and stuff like that. So for the 3-point line, we're going to be making 3 points each week about NBA topics. This week, the first point I would like to make is that Tom Thibodeau isn't the right coach and GM for the Timberwolves. Now, everyone was really excited about this hire, and even I was excited, you know, to an extent when he was hired for the Wolves. I wanted him to be coach of the Rockets, but obviously he wanted GM control, and the Rockets weren't going to give him that. You know, they seem to have made the right choice with D'Antoni, but that's besides the point. Everyone was excited about Thibodeau being the coach. You know, he's going to mold these young players into become a great defensive team, teach them how to win. You know, they'll probably jump up to the playoffs right away. I was not that high on them. I had them missing the playoffs, but still had them, I think, at 40 wins, which they're still not on pace for. I believe they're only on pace for 2 more wins than last year. So that's really, really disappointing. But the thing with Thibodeau is that he's obviously a win-now coach. This is not a guy who's coming around for a rebuild. You know, they hired him, they were like, you know, we're really young, but, you know, we're going to win. But the problem is that because they gave him GM power and he's a win-now coach, we've already heard the rumors about him making win-now moves as GM, which is really worrisome because whenever you mess with a young core that's kind of been together, you know, you never know what's going to happen to the chemistry if you were to bring in someone else. If they were to trade Zach LaVine for an established, you know, other wing player, what does that do to the chemistry? It's very significant right. For a young team. And the thing is that he's not even making his mark on the team. The Wolves are 27th in defensive rating, and Thibodeau's, you know, hallmark is being a great defensive coach.
Right.
And when he was hired, people were like, oh, they're going to be such a great defensive team in the West. They're going to grind out some victories because Thibodeau's there. It's not happening. They're really good offensively. They're top 10, but they're terrible defensively, bottom 3. And the thing is that I'm kind of starting to think that the Thibodeau hire put a lot of pressure from the media and everyone picking the Wolves to make the playoffs, possibly win 50 games. I think that's putting a lot of pressure on the young players who are saying that, you know what, we got this great coach who's famous, who's known for winning right now, win now mode, and everyone's picking us to make the playoffs and win 45 to 50 games. And now I think that that's putting pressure on guys like Towns and Wiggins and LaVine and their whole young team. And I think that the hire is just getting messier. And I think that it will continue to get messier because if they don't win this year, which they're not going to, if they don't win next year, things are going to get really ugly and he's going to make short-sighted moves like Doc has in L.A. But the problem is the difference is that Doc has a team that's in its prime.
Right.
And it's actually, for some of them, past their prime. So Doc is obviously in win-now mode, as the Clippers should be, while Thibodeau is rushing the win-now mode of the Timberwolves. So I think they should have gone with someone younger. And Thibodeau being the win-now guy is not right for the Wolves.
You almost feel that now they would have been better off going with like a young, non-established coach who can grow with the team
as
opposed to Thibodeau, who has had success in the league with the Bulls. And so he sort of came into the job with an idea of what he knows succeeds in a league and would try to fit players into that mold and that necessarily not their role and not the system that would be best for the group of talent that he has in Minnesota. So you would have felt that, like, someone who doesn't have a clear-cut mindset of what each position needs to be and what each role needs to be on the team would have succeeded better because that way he can develop his offensive formula, defensive formula around the players, around the active roster and build and grow with them as opposed to Thibodeau, who is sort of like, I know it works. We're going to do it. We might do it my way and sort of risk the potential of, you know, having success in 3-4 years from now for like try to have some somewhat immediate success.
Yeah, and I'm just so worried about him being the GM as well because we've already heard the rumors about him wanting to get an established player to win now. Now I think that because as the losses pile up, someone hopefully will tell him that this season's a lost cause. Do not trade a young guy for this season. Wait till next season, off season, draft pick because they're going to probably have a good one, especially the way they're playing. Which would then make their team even younger. So I don't know. But I think that this is going to be one of those hires that was sexy when it happened. Everyone was like, oh, Thibodeau, best coach on the market. He's going to mold that team into a great defensive team, mold those young guys into, you know, how they should have the right attitude, how they should play the game, you know. There were concerns about him overplaying his players, and I don't have the minutes per game in front of me for their, you know, top, their quote-unquote big three, but I think their minutes are pretty high. But again, they've been in a lot of close games, they just haven't been able to close them out. So, but yes, I think that in 2 to 3 years, we'll all look back on this, you know, maybe when he's fired by then, and be like, you know what, I think that they should have gone with a young, non-established coach to grow with them, connect with the young guys, because right now it's Thibodeau, 55, he's trying to connect to 20-year-olds.
Right.
I mean, you get a coach like Kenny Atkinson is pretty young. Other coaches, I mean, Brad Stevens would be perfect, that kind of age group where Brad Stevens, you know he's connecting with his guys because he's not that much older than them.
Or also like someone with that college background who can come and be like, almost like that, continue on from the college experience to the NBA for those guys as a nice transition.
Yeah.
As opposed to Thibodeau, who is known to be like a very hard, you know, he practices his players very hard, and like there's been complaints from the Bulls and like Joakim Noah about like their injury history because of Thibodeau and the way he sort of runs his team.
Yeah, and I just think that, I mean, we obviously aren't in the locker room to know how he's connecting or not connecting with the team, how he's treating them, talking with them, you know, trying to pump them up. But just from the outside looking in, it just feels like they should have gone with a younger guy who can connect with the players more and who doesn't have such a reputation and such fame as being a good coach who succeeded, because I think getting Thibodeau has put pressure on their players indirectly. You know, at first they were like really excited, but then they were probably, you know, these players are on social media, they read, they know that people are picking them for 50 wins, top 5 seed, making the playoffs. That puts a lot of pressure on you. They say, oh, our coach is so good, you know, we have to overplay to make sure we get the playoffs. And then that's led to some terrible losses, and people are really looking poorly on the Wolves, especially Thibodeau. His reputation is taking a hit really fast from a lot of people.
And you have to consider what it's going to do to those players' like confidence levels. You know, most of them are young guys. They didn't have the burden of expectation before, and now they come into it, and their first time that there's expectation placed upon them, they're not fulfilling that expectation, and they're sort of receiving that negative criticism and then the limelight in not the positive way. And how is that going to transform how those players develop in the NBA in the coming years? Because they're going to have that first experience be quite poor.
Yeah. I mean, the last thing I'm going to say is that I saw somewhere that the Wolves are actually on pace for 2 more wins, just 2 more wins than they had last year with Sam Mitchell as coach, okay?
Right.
Sam Mitchell isn't in the league anymore.
He's
he was
gone.
That bad, all right? Let's move on to our second point of the week. It's time to accept that three-pointers can and now do correlate with wins. The top 6 teams in three-point percentage are all the best. They have the best 6 records in the league. That's the Cavs, Spurs, Raptors, Rockets, Warriors, and Clippers in the order of their three-point percentage. Again, the records are different, but they still make up the best 6 records in the league. So, again, whenever you hear anyone like Charles Barkley saying that jump shooting teams don't win, I don't think Barkley realizes that the Cavs are and were a jump shooting team when they won last year. The Warriors are clearly a jump shooting team, and they won 2 years ago. I mean, and now you're looking at the tops. Now, this is only the regular season, but these are the 6 best teams in the league, and you would figure if you're going by the consensus finals that it's going to be Cavs Warriors. They're also in the top 6 teams in 3-point percentage, and the Cavs have increased their 3-point shooting in terms of attempts and makes. They've become an elite 3-point shooting team. The Warriors are still elite, and then the other 4 best teams in the league are all in the tops in 3-point percentage. So threes now can, and then now it's basically kind of being proven right now in this regular season. This regular season is proving that threes can and do correlate with wins.
Right, and I think also to build on that fact, not only those this 6 best record teams, but they're also those 6 teams are the 6 most efficient offensive teams in the league. And that's a pretty interesting fact to note, that you know, teams that are shooting a lot of threes, taking a lot of threes, making a lot of threes are becoming some of the most efficient teams offensively in the NBA. And something that I thought about when you brought this up is that, you know, maybe shooting threes and taking threes means a lot more, but also maybe defense means a lot less, because if you look at it, the top 2 of the top 10 most efficient defensive teams in the league have under 500 records. And then if you count Detroit, you know, and you count the Bulls at 11, they're 1 game over or 500. That makes 3 of the top 11 most efficient defensive teams sub 500. Like that's an also interesting thing to consider when you're talking about how offense matters, and also how defense matters in terms of how teams turn out in the league.
Well, the consensus argument has been made that, you know, you can win in the regular season just playing offense, but, you know, obviously when you come down to the playoffs, you're going to need some kind of defense. Now, The Cavs, I believe, are 16th or 17th in defensive rating, so that's, you know, below league average. The Warriors are a really good defensive team in terms of defensive rating now, after a really slow start. But everyone has argued, you know, oh, you know, you can win, you know, winning with offense wins, you know, regular season games. That's been the thing. Like, D'Antoni can win regular season games, a lot of them, because of the system. You can win in the regular season with an elite offense, but always right. the defense will kill you in the playoffs, if, you know, at a certain extent.
Right.
And that's the problem with looking at regular season stats, especially when you're analyzing offense versus defense, because I don't believe that defense wins championships. I think that's just a kind of a cliche saying that you just stick around whenever one team wins and has a little bit better defense than the other.
Right.
I think that it's a combination of both, obviously. Now, obviously, a team that's top five in offense and bottom five in defense is not going to win the title. But, you know, a team like the Rockets, who are top three in offense and now 14th in defensive rating. These are defense and offensive ratings I'm using, by the way. A team like the Rockets, or any team like the Cavs, who are a prohibitive favorite for the title, are right. also top three or top four in offense, and then they're below league average in defense, and yet most people are still picking them to make the finals and or win the finals.
Right.
So you don't need defense to win. Now, of course, a team like the Jazz, who is basically the reverse, or a team like the Grizzlies, who are top five offense, bottom five, top five defense, bottom five offense, you know, those guys also don't make the finals and win championships all the time either. You need to have a nice balance. You need to be basically top 15 and above in both categories, in my opinion, to be a championship winner, because those are elite teams if you're
right.
top 15 in both.
And also the what you need to win changes once you enter the playoffs, because typically when you're getting to the playoffs, not only are the teams better, but also teams are typically better defensively around the board compared to something like if you're playing the Nets versus if you're playing, you know, the Bulls or the Pistons as the Cavs. You know, the Nets are a much worse defensive team than the, let's say, even the Pistons at the eighth seed.
Yeah, and the last thing I'll say about this in terms of analyzing offense versus defense and, you know, the importance of the three-point shooting is that defense, while, yes, you need guys who can, you know, who can defend, defense is an effort thing more than a skill like three-point shooting is. So a team like the Grizzlies, they have guys who can defend, but even when they miss players, which they have so far this season, they've actually improved their defense when they miss Conley and Ennis and Parsons, everything.
Right.
Because defense is an effort thing, so you get guys who come in there and try really hard on defense. They're not going to just – they can't just get a guy who's going to just somehow become a three-point shooter. Like,
right.
It's very hard and very rare that someone just becomes a three-point shooter.
You're not going to pick it up during the year.
Now, it's hard for someone to become an elite defender, but someone can turn in a great defensive season in one season because their effort is increased. And across the board, effort increases on defense in the playoffs. So that's what it is. But three-point shooting, you can't just get. You have to have it. It's a skill you have to have. And it's pretty much been proven in this regular season and the past two NBA championships that threes can and do correlate with wins. And now for the last of our 3 points this week, I have to say that the last two-minute reports need to go. Now, the argument in favor of the last two-minute reports is basically that it holds the league / the refs accountable. So the refs are kind of, you know, they know, hey, they're going to release the last two-minute report, and they could probably say this is going to be, they'll probably say it's a foul, so we should call it a foul or something like that. And it holds the league accountable by saying, hey, we missed this, or, you know, basically our refs missed this, like, sorry, guys. But that's the problem with it, by saying we missed this, sorry, guys. What does that do for anyone except frustrate players, fans, mm-hmm. coaches, executives?
Right.
The refs don't even like it themselves. The Referees Association has been calling for the last two-minute reports to be canceled for years now. And, they just don't do anything. Like, yes, it holds them accountable. Like, the league will say, hey, we got this wrong. But that, by saying that, it doesn't do anything except maybe the league feels better about themselves
right.
by saying we missed this. I mean, it doesn't change the call, doesn't give the win back, doesn't, you know, redo anything. It just tells them, yeah, like, you were fouled. You should have got free throws. That probably would have won the game. Sorry.
Yeah.
Move on. Like, there's no point. I think it's just so unnecessary, and it gets so much attention for, you know, frustrating players and fans and coaches. I mean, numerous players and coaches, obviously the fans have been calling for it to be abolished because it's just so unnecessary. I think it's kind of like an ego thing for the league. Like, hey, like, you know, we review this and we acknowledge that we made a mistake. Now we feel better about ourselves because we
right.
acknowledge to the fans and everyone that we made a mistake. But there's no point because it doesn't add anything back to the teams
right.
and players who were screwed out of the call.
Right, and I agree that as it stands now, it's basically useless. I don't think it needs to go. I think that they need to add more of an accountability factor. Like, let's say a ref makes repeated mistakes in the final 2 minutes or just throughout the game, the NBA acknowledges that, and the refs get put on probation. I mean, this will probably not happen because of the referees' like strong union, but I think that if you were to somehow say, okay, ref, if you make 5 mistakes in a period of 25 games or 20 games, like you're gonna be on probation for, you know, a week or two, and if you make another mistake, you're gonna have to sit out a couple of games, 5-10 games. So I think that if you just, as it stands now, it doesn't hold the refs accountable because it doesn't make them more likely to learn from their mistakes. It angers the fans, it angers the teams, it doesn't really do anything. But if you added accountability, the refs would be forced to go back and look and reevaluate how they make calls in going forward.
Well, I would argue that that would make them kind of more kind of like, get, you know, have their whistle ready to make more calls that aren't calls. But maybe, like, maybe they could overcall. Right, I'm worried about that.
But they could also evaluate if they called a foul that wasn't a foul, they could also be docked for that too. They could be like marked up. They could try to make them make the right calls, not the wrong calls, either calling too many fouls or calling too little fouls.
It's an interesting change now. That would probably make some complications because, as we have seen almost every day, it seems like the last 2-minute report reports an incorrect call or incorrect non-call,
right,
which means you'd have a lot of, you know, referees that would be punished if it builds up really fast. I mean,
right, yeah. I mean, you could.
But then you'd have to bring in more refs.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes it messy when I feel like it'd just be easier just to abolish it. And you know what? When people complain about the calls, like people on Twitter, like, oh, the refs, they missed that call. And then, like, the next day, they were like, they're basically, NBA agrees. Yeah, they missed the call. There's no point in saying that. That reignites the discussion. People have tried to move on, and then they reignite it a day later. It's not like it happens like immediately after because they have to review it. So I think it reignites a discussion that frustrates fans, players, coaches, etc. And it's very pointless. Even the refs don't like it. Just abolish the last 2-minute reports. It's just kind of an ego thing for the league that I'm, you know, starting to have a kind of an issue with because it just seems so unnecessary for essentially no reason. And now let's move on to our next segment.
Now, it's time for Something Foul.
Before we get into Something Foul, I want to remind you that we are brought to you again by Fan Essentials. It's a really great subscription service. What you do is you go to fanessentials.net, you choose your sport, and then you choose your favorite team within that sport from, you know, NFL, NBA, MLB, NHL. I think they have MLS as well. And then you choose your favorite team, you choose your subscription size, so it's small, medium, or large, and then that dictates what size box you get. And then each month, a box of your favorite team's gear is shipped right to your door. I've tried it for the Rockets. It's really cool. They give you unique gear that you really can't find anywhere else, kind of local stuff that you can't just buy on NBA store, you know, stuff like that. And it's really cool. It's just shipped right to your door. It's really easy. And again, if you use promo code 94FEET in all caps, you get 30% off your first subscription of Fan Essentials. So as you heard from that little drop there, this is Something Foul, our fifth segment, because we're now at the free throw line. And essentially this segment is going to replace what was our running segment on previous episodes, which was Worst of the Week. So Something Foul, as you can probably tell from the titles, you know, someone or something, or, you know, a storyline, a team, a player, an executive, etc., who has done wrong, you know, in the eyes of the 94 Feet Report, and usually me, because I'm usually here by myself. So essentially Something Foul is replacing Worst of the Week. So Something Foul for me this week, it's Mark Stein. So I know we have disagreed about this.
Yes.
So I think it was on a Saturday that Mark Stein was continuing to come out with his trimester awards, you know, posts or whatever. And I guess my worst of the week isn't necessarily Stein, as in it's more of changing MVP narratives, you know, on the fly, basically, to kind of, you know, support your pick. Now, the thing is that Stein in his article, again, this is only one trimester, but the problem I have with it is that he's laying the foundation for his voting, you know, his voting patterns at the end of the year. Now, obviously, you can change, people do change, but when he went this strong into, you know, kind of convincing himself within his own article, I'm kind of concerned that, or, you know, kind of confident that he's going to keep this voting pattern going. So Stein, in his article, he says he's voting, right now it's Russ is the MVP. But in the article, the problem I had was that one of his key points was that Harden leans on Eric Gordon and Patrick Beverley. And this brought me back to 2015, in which case Stein voted for Steph Curry in 2015. But it's clear that Steph Curry was on the better team than James Harden was in 2015. Because
right.
Steph Curry was surrounded with Klay Thompson and Draymond Green, Andre Iguodala off the bench, you know, Steph and the Warriors were the better team, and yet he still voted for Curry. Meanwhile, Harden had basically Monty Unis as his second best player in 2015 because Dwight missed 41 games. Maybe you can argue Trevor Ariza, that doesn't really make it any sexier. So in my opinion, I think Harden in this kind of MVP climate, Harden is essentially 2015 Steph, great player on a better team, and then Russ is essentially 2015 Harden. So by Stein saying he's voting for Russ this year, but he voted for Curry in 2015. He's contradicting himself kind of right there. That's, mm-hmm. in my opinion, is very hypocritical. And second of all, I just want to point out the funny thing that Stein was very confident that the Thunder would be better than the Rockets this year. He had them significantly better. He had them at a 50-plus win team, and he had the Rockets barely, I think, at 41 and 41. So now, I mean, obviously that can change, and people can admit that he was wrong, but I think I just want to put that out as something funny because he was, like, very confident about that. And just want to add that shortly before we came on the air to record this episode, Stein came out with his power rankings, and in his... Obviously, he sets a paragraph up for each team just to explain their ranking. In the Rockets' ranking, I think they have two sentences about what they've been doing. And before he goes straight to talking about his defending his Westbrook pick, because he obviously saw how the backlash on right. Twitter, because Rockets' Twitter is pretty aggressive, I must say. So I thought that just made him even worse of the week. Like, Stein, can you at least talk about the Rockets being on a 10-game winning streak and, you know, their comeback? And they'll just go straight to Russ. That added to worst of the week. And it's not only Stein, it's just people in general who are changing MVP narratives based on how they're picking. Because right. Stein is clearly trying to manipulate this race when he voted the complete opposite way in 2015.
Right, and I think I made this point to you before off air, but I think that I said that I think that Stein was differentiating. He could argue he has chosen not to based on his post today on the Rockets power ranking, NBA power ranking. But he could have chosen to make the argument stating that this year Westbrook's stats are better than the stats that James Harden put up in 2015. Do you agree with that statement?
Of course.
Right. And so I think that he could have easily made the argument saying, yes, I voted for Steph Curry in 2015 over James Harden. And this year I'm voting for Russell Westbrook, not because I disagree with how I voted in 2015, but this year Westbrook's stats are better than James Harden stats from 2015.
I get that, but then taking this year individually, he's voting for the player with better stats on the worst team in the standings. That's contradicting his voting methods. I know Russ's stats are better than Harden's were in 2015, but just don't even take 2015. Just look at this year.
Right.
And then looking at his voting pattern in 2015 and his voting pattern this year. This year he's voting for Russ, the better stats, worst team in the standings. 2015 he voted for and should have voted for Harden if he's doing this again, because Harden was the better stats, worst team,
right.
even though they were second in the conference, which I think is a significant thing to point out as well. He's voting for, if let's say the standings ended today, like how they were. Rockets are 3, Thunder are 7. In 2015, Warriors were 1, Rockets were 2. It was coming from, you know,
right.
that's significant as well. But I'm saying, look at this year individually. He's choosing stats over standings, basically.
Right, but in his evaluate, he doesn't give an exact criteria to how much weight he gives.
Of course
to
not, because then we would be able to specifically point
right.
out what
so
he's doing.
So it could be possible that yes, the Rockets were good, and yes, Steph Curry had more help in 2015 than James Harden did. But in 2017 award season, James Harden had more help, but Westbrook's stats were better, therefore he deserves more. He earns the vote of Mark Stein because his stats were better than James Harden. So therefore, his stats compared to James Harden's stats outweigh the value of added help.
But I still don't. Yes, you can argue that. I still don't think that the difference in statistics would add up the value of being the difference in seeds, which they are or might be yeah. in terms of 2015 to 2017.
And to be fair, Mark Stein did not make the argument that I am presenting here for him. He just said that – he basically said that it's now, and it doesn't – just because I voted this way doesn't mean I'm going to vote that way at the end of the season.
Yeah, that's not what he said in the article. That's what he said in today's power
right.
ranking, saying that
that's his defense
based on the
his...
first trimester, because I think he's only saying this because people went crazy on Twitter. I mean, I had a tweet that was retweeted 17 times and liked 18 times because I basically said he's a hypocrite, but – I think he could have done that somewhere else. I think using the power rankings to not talk about the Rockets is a little
right.
bit, you know, kind of like egotistical. Like, all right, but that's enough, Mark Stein. My something foul is basically changing MVP narratives, which is basically what I saw the most from Mark Stein. But mm-hmm. I know you have someone else to talk about.
So now I have a former Rocket, Dontis Montiunas. He is my something foul of the week. I just think that the way, and I know you've talked about this a lot, but I think that the way that he and his agent went about handling the entire contract situation was gone about very poorly. He's probably likely going to have to sit out most of the, not the whole year, just simply because he's not going to be able to get the contract that he wants from any team now. And it basically just ruined his, I would say very much damaged his reputation in the league. It just raised a lot of questions. No one wants to sit out a year, especially, you know, you're in your younger ages. So I think that it could have been completely avoided, and yet they chose to set out and take the most difficult path forward, and now they're stuck there for at least another year. So I think that Dontis Montiunas is my something foul of the week.
This is, I mean, obviously I'm a Rockets fan. I write for the Dream Shake. This is one of the most interesting and curious and confusing and no one knows what's going on situations in NBA history, I think, because this has been one of the, obviously he was a restricted free agent. The Rockets could not get a deal. No one offered him anything for the Rockets to match in the offseason.
Right.
The Rockets could not get a separate deal done. They obviously offered him the qualifying offer of $4 million a year, which a lot of people argued he should have taken just to play better and get a bigger contract next season. Didn't do that. He wanted a long-term contract. They couldn't come up to an agreement before a deadline of November 23rd, in which case, even if he signed afterwards, he cannot be traded that season, which handicaps because Daryl Morey loves to trade at the trade deadline. And then the Nets come in along and offer him a kind of weird contract with a lot of incentives and stuff like that. The Rockets match, but the thing that a lot of people don't know is, or they do now because the situation is being so exposed, but at the time, a lot of people didn't know that the Rockets, by matching, they didn't have to match the weird incentives that the Nets included. They only had to match the base salary, which is only $31 million, not the $39 that was reported. That pissed off Montiunas and his agent, B.J. Armstrong, who should also be included in something, Val, because this guy should be fired immediately.
Yes.
But anyways, so they said, oh, you know what, we're not coming because of the $6 million difference in incentives, which still is kind of ridiculous for me. I mean, he's got the contract for multiple years. You wanted the long-term deal at a pretty reasonable salary for your player in this kind of market. Just take it.
Right.
But there was clearly something wrong. Clearly, he said all the right things that, oh, I want to come back to Houston. I'll play for any team. Clearly, he did not want to be back in Houston because he could have if he wanted to.
Right.
Didn't do that. Then they throw that contract out the window and sign him to a completely new contract that was very team-friendly because it had three team options each July for the next three seasons, which is somehow incredible. I don't know how Morey was able to do that to Armstrong after, again, Armstrong should be fired. Anyways, so then they have that contract signed, and then we're like, oh, the situation is over. He'll be rejoining the team by next week. And then 2 days later, they just let him go to unrestricted free agency because of something wrong with the physical now.
Right.
Because they said that they brought him in for a physical. He said he came to the arena for the physical and was told to go home. He was told by Rockets team executives to go home because something was up with the physical. And then a couple days later, they released a statement by saying, after conversing with Montiunas and his representatives and the league office, we have decided to let him go to unrestricted free agency. So that means the league came into the situation and tried to resolve it, which means there's something wrong with his back. Maybe it's completely done. But again, he said that the Nets passed. He passed the physical with the Nets. So we don't know. Maybe the Nets are misleading there. I mean, I don't know. There might be something completely wrong with his back. There was certainly something wrong with him playing in Houston. And I don't blame him because the way the Rockets are playing, he would have been, you know, fighting for minutes. I mean, obviously he's a better player than, you know, guys like Harrell right now. But, you know, Harrell and Decker are playing really well for their age and a lot better than people expected. So do you want to mess that up? When this was going on, the Rockets were, you know, building their 10-game winning streak. You messed that up by bringing Montiunas in there. I mean, I was the one who said he should have been brought back and was happy when they, you know, re-signed him, that he provides depth for injury just in case. Ryan Anderson, of course, can always get hurt. You know, Clint Capella has an injury right now. You know, stuff like that. Injury depth. And, of course, Montiunas can shoot the three reasonably well for a 7-footer and can pass, two things that Mike D'Antoni loves in a big man. So I thought it would be a perfect fit. Now I'm seeing that. I mean, obviously the depth problem is still there, but they don't need Montiunas. They've won 10 straight games with guys like Decker and Harrell filling in for most of the roles. So, I mean, not only Montiunas, but B.J. Armstrong has got to be something foul.
Something foul.
Surprised he's still hired as an agent for Montiunas.
We don't know for how much longer, though.
I mean, and I write for the Dream Shake, as I mentioned, and one of our staff writers wrote a winners and losers. And obviously Armstrong and Montiunas were both winners and losers because, you know, they got out of Houston but now still don't have contract. So they're both winners and losers, I guess, if they want to look at that way.
Right.
And then The loser was also the Rockets because this made them look like a shrewd kind of team. I mean, I see no problem with the way they handled things. I thought Monty Unis and Armstrong were more unreasonable, but there is just such a messy situation. I think the Rockets basically were like, you know what, we're just done. Just leave us alone. Go away. We don't want to see you ever again. Please, you've messed us up for like 3 weeks now.
Right.
Actually, it's been months ongoing because they've been trying to negotiate a contract since summer.
Off season.
So that's your something foul. My something foul is changing MVP narrative. So Alex, I'd like to thank you for joining us again on this episode of the 94 Feet Report. Just throw out where everyone can follow you on Twitter.
Of course. Thanks for having me. And you can follow me on Twitter at Spyro1495. And I look forward to coming on again sometime soon.
Yeah, hopefully we'll be able to have you on in the next coming weeks. And just in a little bit, we'll be able to start our final segment.
Finally, it's time for the N1.
So if you couldn't hear our Australian friend there, it's time for the And One. So the And One is going to be basically a segment where each week we will kind of talk about something to look forward to in the next week of the NBA season. So kind of a weekly what to look forward to. And we will essentially start the baseline of the next week by, of course, mentioning and analyzing what we talked about on the And One the previous week here on the 94 Feet Report. Obviously, with this week being Christmas included in this week, at the end of the week on Sunday, it's hard not to have the And One be the Christmas Day games. Now, in terms of the actual Christmas Day game, they're not all hits. Obviously, we mentioned them before. We've got Celtics-Knicks starting off the day, then the big juicy Cavs-Warriors game. Then you've got, I believe it's Wolves-Thunder, and then Bulls-Spurs, and then Clippers-Lakers. So obviously, you know, Thunder versus the Wolves isn't exactly a juicy matchup, I mean, in terms of the records of the teams, and either is Clippers-Lakers. But the other, you got big teams playing. Celtics-Knicks is a rivalry, and both teams are above 500 fighting for playoff seeding in the East. And as we talked about earlier in the show, the playoff, you know, seeds 3 through 11 in the East are wide open, basically. So that's a big game. Obviously, that starts off the game. That starts off the day at noon in New York. So Celtics-Knicks is a game to look forward to. Obviously, Cavs-Warriors is the juicy game to look forward to. Everyone's looking forward to how, you know, obviously it's a finals matchup. And even though these teams are in different conferences, this is essentially right now the premier rivalry in the NBA. They're slated to meet for a third straight time in the finals. Who knows how many more years in the future they meet in the finals as well. We want to see how the Cavs handle the new look Warriors. They've added Kevin Durant. How Durant's addition, you know, kind of changes this rivalry and stuff like that. So that's obviously the juicy matchup everyone's looking forward to and has been looking forward to for the whole season so far, because we're waiting for the Cavs-Warriors matchup, and they only meet 2 times a year, I believe. And then I think that you can argue that, you know, Minnesota versus OKC is a game to look forward to, because although the records are not good, especially for the Wolves, the Thunder are a good team, the Wolves are not, you still, when you want to watch a game, you want to watch for kind of, some games you just watch for individual talent more than, like, the two records of the team. Now, it's not a Cavs-Warriors in the fact that both teams have great records and great players. But while both teams, the Wolves and the Thunder, are not great teams, both teams surely have individual great talent. You've got Russell Westbrook, which is just a must-watch every night. And then you've got the young core, which, again, the record is not good at all, but they are still playing well. And that Wolves lost to the Rockets on Saturday. Karl Anthony Towns had like 41 points, 15 rebounds, 5 assists. Like, you're going to watch the Wolves-Thunder game, if you're not a fan of either team, you're going to watch that game for the individual talent. Karl Anthony Towns, Zach LaVine, Andrew Wiggins, Russell Westbrook. I mean, some games you just watch for the individual talent over the records. Bulls-Spurs, again, it's two big market teams, not market, but, you know, famous teams. Bulls and Spurs are two of the most famous teams in the NBA. Obviously, Spurs are elite, and the Bulls are basically a 500 team right now, but that game you're still going to watch because, you know, it's intriguing, different conferences. You know, the Bulls have been struggling while the Spurs have been thriving. So you're going to watch that game. And then Clippers-Lakers, I mean, by that time at 10:30 at night, you know, you're kind of like exhausted. You've already watched enough NBA basketball. You're probably going to have that on the background, or, you know, not watch it at all because it's going to be a blowout probably. But it is still the LA rivalry, and even though the Clippers have dominated recently, you never know. The Lakers are fun and exciting and, you know, pretty tough to beat this season, so that could change as well. So that's a game to watch. So while not all games are great games in terms of team records, every game has some kind of individual talent to watch. You know, Porzingis in the Knicks-Celtics game, Melo, obviously, Cavs-Warriors, obviously, is the one to watch. Wolves-OKC, you got Russ, Towns, you know, et cetera. Bulls-Spurs, you know, you got the three, the big three of the Wolves. You got Kawhi Leonard on the Spurs. And then, obviously, the Clippers-Lakers rivalry is something to watch as well, even with Blake Griffin being out of that game. But also, the thing about Christmas Day and Christmas Day games is also basically it's the time when a lot of more fans start paying attention to the NBA. That's being more casual fans. Obviously, the hardcore fans have been paying attention since preseason or since the offseason. They never stop paying attention. But in terms of casual fans, you know, people on TV, talk show hosts, you know, First Take, Undisputed, all those shows, ESPN SportsCenter, you know, stuff like that. All those shows will start paying more attention to the NBA, which means it gets more coverage, more discussion, more debate, more analysis. It just increases kind of like the circulation of the NBA. Basically, you know, people have said in the past, you know, no one pays attention to Christmas. Why not just start the season on Christmas? Well, obviously the NBA is not going to do that because that cuts their revenues down. But realistically, for a majority of casual NBA fans, this Christmas Day is basically the starting point of their NBA season because they don't really pay attention to the first 2 months except for briefly checking the standings and the stats and, you know, going on social media. But so Christmas Day is essentially that kind of landmark where people really start focusing on the NBA and talking about it more, which obviously makes it more fun because more points of view are discussed, more, you know, debates and analysis, etc. So this week's N1 on the 94 Feet Report are the Christmas Day games. And again, we'll recap Christmas Day games in depth on next week's Baseline. That'll pretty much cover up the entire Baseline because, you know, Christmas Day is a really big day for the NBA. So we'll cover that on next week's Baseline of the show again. So with that, that's going to conclude this new style show of the 94 Feet Report. Again, it is Monday, December 19th. Again, if you missed the beginning of the show, we are now going to be focusing on, you know, structuring the podcast based on the title of the show, the 94 Feet Report, obviously for the 94 feet, which is the length of the basketball court or an NBA court for that matter. So each of our segments, we start off with the Baseline, then we go to full court press, then half court heave, then 3 points, then something foul, and then we finish with and one. We're covering the 94 feet of an NBA court and structuring it that way. So this is the new structure of the show moving forward. We have not made a decision on the continuation of Free Talk Friday, though I'm fully in favor of continuing Free Talk Friday in kind of a free-flowing, casual conversation manner. But moving forward, the 94 Feet Report NBA podcast will cover what you need and want to know on the NBA on a weekly basis while running through the 94 feet length of an NBA court. As always, we are brought to you by Fan Essentials. Use promo code 94 feet at checkout and by Daily Fantasy Nerd. I am your host, as always, Eric Spropolis. You can follow me on Twitter at Eric Spiros. You'll get all the information for the podcast, and you can find my other work for The Dream Shake and NBA Lead, of course. So follow me on Twitter at Eric Spiros. You can follow and find the show on Twitter and Facebook at the 94 Feet Report Basketball Podcast. And we will be back on Friday for Free Talk Friday, and then again next Monday for the new for the next installment of our new structured show. Have a great week of watching NBA basketball, and particularly enjoy Christmas Day. Take care, everyone.